Yeah, so I gave this talk a title about 20 minutes ago, The Deeper Significance of Sangha. which actually is very helpful because that actually is what the talk about is actually hopefully going to evoke. So I'm just struck just sitting up here actually, looking at you guys and being slightly off the ground, and then just looking to my left and just seeing this incredible Buddha Rupa figure, which from this perspective looking up is almost slightly scary, I have to say. It evokes this sense of mystery, which Sangha in a way is a context for, you could say, what this figure represents, and somehow my position in relation to this figure just feels completely appropriate somehow. In a way, although I'm up here giving a talk, it's really, hopefully the talk is coming from the Buddha in a sense. So hopefully I can do some kind of justice to that. I probably won't, but you know, I'll do my best. Anyway, just to say, I really just really appreciated this weekend. Really, really enjoyed spending time with you all. Some of you I know very well, some of you I don't, but again, you know, as Dharmanatha was saying, it's not about getting to know everyone particularly well, it's just this sense of harmony, this sense of simplicity in our communication with one another over this weekend that's just been really noticeable, right from the word go. It just seems to have settled so quickly, and we've been, in a way, exploring our lives together over this weekend, very intimately, and very bravely and courageously too. And it's just something very wonderful, being with men in a context together doing that. It's so precious in our world. It's unusual. It's a very unusual thing. A kind of context situation for men to come together and actually just share their lives with one another in a deeper way. So I've just been really appreciating that and enjoying that so much. And in a way, it's a shame we have to leave, but leave we must. And we're getting to that stage of the retreat where we're beginning to think about facing the world again, facing our own particular lives, our own individual lives and all of that, as well as the wider world beyond that. And in a way, we've covered this territory of the group and the individual, and trying to sort of get a sense of the distinction between the two, and hopefully getting our sense of ourselves and our lives as individuals, as agents to some degree of their own lives, in relation to their values. But in a way, there's much that isn't the end point. There's a lot more to come. And last night we had a puja, didn't we? We had a sevenfold puja, which Art City very evocatively introduced. In a way, the puja is a kind of is an expression of this this sense of more to come, something beyond the individual. The puja is a kind of an enactment or a kind of drama, kind of form of theatre that evokes the heart, evokes the language of the heart and of the imagination, and evokes something kind of mysterious. Once you start to really listen to it, you kind of get behind the words to some kind of deeper meaning. There's this sense of the individual in a relationship to something much, much bigger. So that's why puja is so necessary, because in a way what we're talking about is something that language starts to kind of, we start to run out with language. Language seems to reach a bit of a dead end and we can't say any more beyond a certain point. And that's why puja is really necessary, to evoke this something more, using our imaginations, using the language of the heart, and so on and so forth. And so in a way, that's the sort of theme of this talk. I'm trying to create some kind of context for where we're going. But maybe just to recap a little bit of where we've been already. So just to say about We've explored individual consciousness and group consciousness. I think that's how we talked about it. And Bhante Sangharakshita has quite a nice definition of an individual, which I'll just read out to you. So he says, and I don't know where this is from, actually. Arch City sent an email around and he quoted this, so I'm trusting your source was reliable, Arch City. But I thought it was quite nice. Anyway, he says, the individual... So the individual characterized by relative emancipation from group conditioning, relatively integrated and aware, and with an inner direction and positive purpose to their lives. So that's something about an individual. So, and again, we were exploring that in our talks yesterday. We had some great talks from the three guys yesterday morning, and then we, in our groups, we talked about our lives into the sense of our inner direction. What is our inner direction? Where is the positive purpose to our lives? In a way, there's a sort of a kind of a sense of ourselves emerging from our groups, our various groups that we're born in. We're kind of born with, on one hand, we join with, whether it's like work or other contexts. We inevitably form part of groups in our lives. And yet the individual emerges from the group. As soon as some kind of glimmer of awareness starts to come in, the individual can start to ask questions, can start to find out what is actually most important, and not, in a sense, what they've been conditioned to think about or conditioned to uphold as being valuable. The individual can start to, in a way, live their own lives from their own inner sense of values. So it's very, it's a lofty thing. That in itself is a lofty thing, and it's not to be underestimated. To the extent that we've done that, and we all have to some degree, to the extent that we've done that, it is quite an achievement. And it does represent a new kind of consciousness. So the individual consciousness is a kind of, well, you know, it's a step forward in terms of, in relationship to the group consciousness. It's something distinct. It is essentially creative in scope. It's something creative rather than reactive. You could say it's, again, characterized by awareness, perspective, a sense of perspective on life, a sense of its relationship to others, again, as distinct from the individualist, which I think we probably mentioned in the talks as well, the individualist who lives for themselves above and beyond everybody else, the kind of separation, which, again, seems to characterize a lot of our culture at the moment, the kind of culture of individualists. So a real distinction needs to be made between the individual and the individualist. And the individual, in a way, sort of can feel themselves separate, but also is aware of their relationship to others, their kind of deeper intimacy and connection. And an individual can, of course, see what's positive in the group. You know, we don't want to sort of demonize the group in any sense. There is something positive about our groups, our various groups. It's positive and important to have a healthy relationship with a kind of conditioning in some sense. We're not kind of, as Bhante says, an individual is only relatively emancipated, but not completely. We're still sort of defined by our kind of group conditioning. And it's important to sort of have a sense of the value of that, and as well a sense of being critical of that as well. So I was trying to think in my own life, an example of this. And in the classic example that always comes to mind, I mentioned it in my life story yesterday, is being born into a kind of very dominant Catholic culture in Ireland, in the sort of 1980s, 1990s. Very different from what it's like now. Very, almost entirely different country now. But back then, there was still this background of Catholicism. It was very, very strong, very traditional in many, many respects. And of course, I grew up in that. unquestionably believing that there was a God and that there was a heaven and a hell and so on and so forth, because that's just what you're told. You know, that's just, it's part of the air you breathe. You don't see anything beyond that. You can't imagine anything beyond that. But of course, you know, over time, as I got a bit older, you know, maybe where this came from, but, you know, I was able to sort of look at the kind of, what I was being told and well, think for myself, did I actually really believe this? Did I really believe that there was a God? Did I really believe there was a heaven and a hell? And I kind of decided, well, actually, I don't. I don't know where or when that happened, but it just very kind of quickly, at some point, it just didn't make any sense. I didn't believe in it. Of course, at the same time, there was a lot of scandal within the church, a lot of doubt crept in, and there was also increasing kind of material prosperity in the country, increasing liberal kind of political policies and so on and so forth, which totally changed the landscape of the culture in a major way. Overnight, it seemed, you know. And I grew up at that point where the traditional way of life turned into a much more modern, liberal kind of views. And so I kind of was really reactive to Catholicism. I thought it was terrible, there was nothing good about it, you know, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, as I've got older, and particularly as I kind of came across the Dharma, I started to become more appreciative of it. I started to become a bit more like, well, it gave me a certain kind of foundation, a certain kind of sense of ethics, a certain kind of sense of that there was something beyond the material. There was something unexplainable about reality, it seemed to me. That's a kind of intuition of that. It was just that the kind of group kind of narrative didn't quite fit, didn't quite meet that intuition. So I was able to sort of separate myself from that in a way, be left with that question of, well, where does this intuition actually find some kind of sense of satisfaction? Anyway, that's when I came across the Dharma, that's when I came across Buddhism, and that seemed more than adequately meet that intuition, very satisfactorily. And of course, when it comes to Buddhism, you have to be enough of an individual to become a Buddhist. So that's the thing. You can't. Bhante says somewhere that you can't be born a Buddhist, even though, you know, you have in traditional Asian countries, you have a Buddhist culture that people are born into. But, I mean, Sangharakshita makes a distinction that you can only be a Buddhist as soon as you become aware that you can make the choice to become a Buddhist, something like that. So it's an act. It has to be a kind of decisive act, an act of the individual. It's not something that, for me at least, maybe something as someone from the sort of West, it's like it has to be something that you decide to do, not something that you just sort of go along with. Anyway, so the sense of an individual, it's almost necessary, it seems to me, that you have to at some point feel a sense of your aloneness. You have to sort of feel at least temporarily separate from the group. And that might be quite uncomfortable in some ways. What came to me yesterday when we were doing our life stories was when I was talking about myself and the various groups I was sort of involved with, it was the sense of having to kind of peel myself away from it. Like, you know, there's almost that sense of kind of discomfort, you know, of having to kind of separate myself out, knowing that this wasn't quite what I wanted. This, I wanted more of a sense of my own values and inner direction. But it's not, I can't find it here. I need to kind of step outside of that. And it kind of happens in small little ways. Like, I think, like, you know, certain, being around certain friends who were, you know, who like to get drunk and all the rest of it, you know, and making a decision at some point, well, I don't really want to do that anymore. And then having to kind of feel the kind of funny looks you get, you know, when you step outside of that kind of, that shared comfort. It's almost like the group is like this shared security. It's like, this is our group. And if anyone tries to go be outside of the group, you know, it's suspicious. It threatens the security of the group because we're in this together, right? You know, if one of us separates outside, you know, the group becomes threatened to some degree. See, it feels to me necessary to sort of feel that discomfort as part of this process. A positive sense of aloneness, maybe you could say. Or maybe you could say it's just trying to take responsibility for yourself. Trying to take yourself seriously. Your life is your business in some sense. I mean, not completely, but there has to be this sense of bringing awareness of inner agency, that only the sense of inner agency can make the right choices in your life, which is not easy. And it's interesting with the life stories yesterday, just how much kind of dissatisfaction and discontent there was, you know. And I always think there's like something really valuable about that. When you hear a life story, and when I hear people talking about the difficulties, I sort of feel it's just so much more real in a way. It's so much more real. It just feels much more human to acknowledge this kind of territory. I always feel much more connected to people when I hear about the difficulties and the struggles to become, you know, an individual. It's like if somebody just talks about how great their life's been and how, like, you know, how great they are, it's just not. Like, there's no connection, but like when someone talks about the struggles, the very human struggles, or in other words, dukkha, as the Buddha would say, the dukkha of life, that is intimately connecting. So as I was saying, so becoming an individual is a hard-fought thing, to any degree we've done it, you know. It's to be applauded. And even in our wider culture where we see people in, you know, various spheres, whether it's the arts, you know, music, sports, people who are willing to take a risk in some way and create something new. Well, you know that feeling of like when you like read a book or you watch a film or you listen to some music and just for a moment you're in touch with something, a sense of something more, like a creative possibility. It's like, wow, this is something new. And you just have this sense of like gratitude as well. Like, this person has created something and brought something into the world. And you just want to say, like, I'm just so grateful that these people live. Like, these great filmmakers, these great musicians, these great authors, even like great athletes, you know, when they put forward into kind of new territory. It's like amazing, it's exhilarating. And we kind of rightly celebrate that in our culture. I think it's really, really important that we acknowledge and celebrate and feel gratitude to those people who live from a kind of sense of vision and are prepared to kind of do anything to live that out. And yet, at the same time, although that's much to be applauded, it doesn't feel like enough. As great as these people are, there's something kind of missing. There's something missing in that sort of perspective. In a way, partly what it seems to me is that you have to sort of put the individual in relationship to the broader context of the world, the broader cultural context. So just simply being an individual on its own doesn't seem to be enough. Because we're affected by the kind of world, the world narrative, the world views, the world culture we live in. And to me, as I kind of sometimes, from what I can learn of the things that go on in our world, whether the things of politics, the things of kind of cultural views and so on and so forth, that we're living in a kind of fragmented and divisive kind of world at the moment. I think there's no kind of getting away from that. The world, as presented to us by the kind of institutions of media, the institutions of politics, present a very fragmented world, a kind of a disconnected world, a kind of a world without a bigger vision. The bigger vision seemingly being progress at all costs, progress of economic, material comfort at all costs. And the consequences of that, the kind of breakdown of community, the breakdown of supportive conditions that enabled an individual to make sense of life in some kind of meaningful way. You know, we've seen the sort of the impact of very materialist views in our culture, the idea that there is nothing more to life than what we see in front of us and what our senses perceive. Dead matter. We sort of live in this kind of dead, inanimate world, which we can use for our own pursuits of comforts and pleasure, which we can exploit. This is the kind of world we find ourselves in, and increasingly so. Technology is taking us far beyond almost anything beyond human. We're entering a kind of new, slightly, feels, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm just really pessimistic, but a kind of slightly dystopian technological revolution. it's like Blade Runner, you know. I've never seen that. Anyway. That new Blade Runner film that came out recently, it's a horrible world. I don't know if anyone's seen it. I thought it was a really terrifying world of a vision of our future, a kind of cold, alienated, robotic, digital sort of world. It just like lacked anything kind of remotely warm or human. Anyway, won't go there. Anyway, so that's the kind of world we're in. That's the kind of that's the cultural context. Not completely. I'm painting a pretty specific picture, but you know, you get my point. We're affected by that as people. We're affected by the views around us. Historically, the West was Christian. The West was a place of Christian ideals and Christian vision. It's no longer the case. It's still there, but because of various conditions, whether it's the kind of over-literalism of Christianity, the kind of dogmatic approach that people eventually, power, corruption, and all the rest of it, you know, we sort of took kind of an aversion to that, and we became more interested in, well, science, the more scientific views about how reality is, the more material views. So there's been a kind of reaction from the kind of vision of God and the kind of eternalist approach and understanding to a kind of almost a very nihilistic kind of conditioning where we're suspicious of anything other than, you know, materialism. We're kind of dubious, critical, cynical. You know, life is just, you know, about pleasure, you know, that's the sort of end game. And yet at the same time, this individualist culture has sort of emerged, a kind of consumer culture that the world should conform to what you want. You can have what you want. The world should cater to your personal preferences. And despite that kind of individualism, there's still a need to belong. We still want to belong to something. There's still the pull of the group. There's still our tribes. We now have political tribes or social tribes. And increasingly, they're becoming more and more divided. There's more suspicion. There's more mistrust. You know, you can add your own sort of contemporary political issue. I won't suggest any that might spring to mind when you think of a divided society or divided culture. One, I think it begins with B. Anyway. And of course, all this is fueled by the media. And I think it was Kula Deepa said yesterday about the media as being institutionalized delusion. And we're so saturated by this, these forces. And what we're left with, in a sense, is the polarization of self and other. Polarization of self and other, which essentially is suffering, isn't it? It's like when we feel isolated, in relationship to everything beyond us, it's suffering. Whether it's the group in isolation to everything else, that's suffering too. So a kind of suffering world that needs a bigger solution, that needs a bigger vision. If you think about the environment and the task at hand to in a way make a change in how and what's happening to our environment, our planet, we need something more than just politics. You know, politics is not going to do it. You know, whether it's left or right, none of those on their own are going to do it. We need something much more, something that unifies humanity, a bigger vision. We need a spiritual vision. That's the only thing, a spiritual solution to the problems in the world. A transcendental ideal. And that's been lost in our fragmented world. We've lost a sense of the sacred, a sense of the divine, a sense of something more coming into being beyond the individual, beyond the group. The world needs a community of individuals united behind a common vision. That is what Sangha is. That's what spiritual vision is. That is what the community is. Spiritual community is a living out this unified vision on the basis of our connectedness to each other, our connectedness to the world, to the nature. Individual consciousness goes so far, it's a necessary step out of the group, but then it needs to reconnect with other individuals in the context of community. And it's a spiritual matter. It's not something. It's not a political affair. Or it's not a technological affair. Although those things support, you know, it's valuable living in a liberal culture because we can practice Buddhism. That's important. So not to dismiss any of that, but it's not enough on its own. Something else has to come into manifestation. And so it's this sense of the sacred. And it's very interesting being here at Vajrasana over this past few days. It's and again, this Buddha Rupa that we have right at the center of this of Vajrasana, as soon as you come in and you see this, you're in touch, you get a glimmer of a spiritual vision. It was wonderful last night, just before the puja, just being able to, after the short meditation, just being able to open our eyes and just take this incredible image into our awareness and allow it to speak to us. And in a way, Vajrasana as a place speaks to us in terms of this vision. And I think as soon as we arrived here, we were sort of influenced by that. It's very noticeable that as soon as you come here, you're already participating in something. Something that kind of is exemplified by this figure. This sense of mystery. There is something more that happens between us. So it's like we've been inhabiting a sacred realm over this past couple of days. A more meaningful context that somehow affects how we communicate with one another. Even the fact that everywhere you look, you know, when you're in the lounge, you look outside, you just see nature coming in. Nature is always sort of present here at Vajrasana. It's this sense of like a more meaningful world. And it's not, of course, not just the building. It's not just the kind of the bricks and mortar. It's us. We've come into it and we've kind of created Vajrasana in a sense this weekend. We've sort of lived out that sense of vision. And it's always, every time I'm on a retreat, I'm always in touch with this other possibility, this glimmer that emerges. It's like a perfect melody that comes into being, you know, over the weekend, and then sort of you go back to your life again, and then you just have the faint echoes of it. but you still remember it in your mind, you still remember it in your heart. And it's a reminder that really what we're doing here is what the world needs. This is it. This is human beings being together, sharing their lives together, in a way committing to each other, because that's a scary thing to do. Like, we've all just told intimate details of our lives to maybe strangers, you know, that we never met before on Friday, and we've done that. And what an atmosphere it's created, and what a gift to give to the world when we go back home. That is the gift we can give. We've been inhabiting a kind of sacred realm over this weekend. And I need to speed up. And this is our gift. This is the movement from I to we, as Kula Deepa was saying yesterday. The movement from or me to we, I should say. I always find myself, I'm so less interested in myself when I'm on a retreat. Not, you know, I'm still very important, of course, don't get me wrong. But, like, my normal concerns about, what am I going to do? And, I don't want this, I want that, I don't want that. You know, it's sort of not there. I experience it myself completely differently. Of course, what we've been doing on retreat is committing. We've been acting from a place of commitment. We've committed to being here. Whether we were scared about it or not, we committed to being here, and we're here. And now, it feels to me, there's been a response. And that's always the case when you commit. When you commit, there's a response. And where that response comes from is hard to say. But of course, you're stepping into the unknown. Every retreat is always a step into the unknown. And I quite like that, you know, this thing about stepping into the unknown. I suppose it evokes, to some degree, the language of initiation, which is another kind of term that we've sort of lost a little bit, this language of initiation, particularly as men. I think men need to have a sense of initiation, a kind of taking a risk and becoming reborn. That's my sense of what initiation is. It's kind of like you step outside of the comfort and the familiar into unknown territory in order to be reborn, to reimagine yourself as new. I think when I was younger, like my sense of initiation, I picked it up, I think, was just like getting drunk. It was like, when you become like old enough, you're like, all right, now you can go and get drunk. That's your initiation. There you go. Good luck with the rest of your life. And that's not to be critical of anybody, because that's just what you're given. It's just what's handed down by the group. And in no way is that adequate. But there is another kind of initiation, and a few of us have had that. Those of us who have joined the order have been initiated into, well, in a way, we've been initiated into the lineage of the Buddha. That's probably the simplest way of putting it. We all took that decisive act of, to the extent that we were individual enough to make the choice, we consciously chose to the act of ordination. Maybe we didn't choose, but that's another matter. I won't go into that. But we did that. That was a decisive act of commitment in our lives. And, you know, for all of us who've done that, will be the most significant thing we'll have ever done, I'm pretty sure. That, for us, represents a going forth. There's a going forth from our names, even our sense of identities to some extent. We were becoming reborn into a new paradigm, a new kind of vision of what reality really is. Reality as exemplified by this image in front of us. So we joined the order, we were initiated into the order, and the image at the heart of the order, as again was mentioned yesterday, is the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. And Avalokiteshvara is, of course, a bodhisattva figure. Bodhisattvas, in a way, work to bring enlightenment into the world. They're beings who bring enlightenment into the world. And the order is symbolized by this image of Avalokiteshvara, the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. And in a way, it's not just a nice symbol. It's not just a nice, neat, oh yeah, that'll do. That'll be a nice little image. It's something much more than that. And this is where we're starting to go into the territory of the mysterious. And this is where you start to reach a point where, language is starting to fail me now. And whatever I say from here is going to sound a bit, you know, maybe a little bit wild or a little bit kind of, a little bit sort of spooky maybe. but when I was on my ordination course a few years ago, about 4 years ago, I'm very nice to have my Dharma brother, Nyanarishi, down there. He was also on that ordination course. And the two of us, along with many other guys, we basically lived in a context not too dissimilar to this, in the sense of living intimately with one another, practicing meditation, practicing ritual, and so on. We shared our lives with one another, and we did this on the basis of having been ordained into the Tiratana Order. And there was a sense of brotherhood in that kind of very sort of religious sense, but a real sense of brotherhood. We were brothers together. And what seems to have happened over that kind of melting pot, that kind of community context, that order context of people intensively engaging with one another, intensively engaging with their practice, really trying to be individual, but in a way of being individual in relationship to others, is that something starts to become more manifest. Something starts to kind of come into the world. That's the best way of describing it. It's like something starts taking an interest in all of us at that moment. And we've been talking about it in terms of consciousness. We've been talking in terms of group consciousness, of individual consciousness. And this was, very simply, an even newer kind of consciousness. This is the kind of bodhisattva consciousness was coming into being that included the entire world. It included everywhere you looked was sort of imbued by a bigger consciousness. When I reflect on my own ordination, there was just this sense of the whole world, the whole universe was intimately involved. It's like the mountains, the stars, the moon, the sky, the trees were all just sort of listening in. It was just a sense of this is the moment your whole life has just been leading for. You've been looking for this. And now you are reborn. You are reborn into a new paradigm, a new spiritual paradigm, which is the only thing that is going to solve the suffering of the world. And that's just this palpable and tangible sense of meaning. And of course, you cannot communicate that directly. You can only hope it sort of catches people. In the same way, you can only hope that a poem catches people. You can't force it on people. You can't convert people to that. You just have to say, this is what's possible. And what it takes is the individual to make a commitment to doing that. And when the individual does that, the response is so much greater than what you could have imagined. And what I had a sense of on that ordination course was what we were doing as a community. A few weeks ago I met our good friend Sadaketu, who also lives here, but he's not here this weekend, unfortunately. He was ordained with us, and he reminds me of something I'd said, and I'd kind of forgotten about this on that ordination course. But I had a sense of what we were doing as a community of brothers practicing. It was like we were living in this wonderful palace, this incredible palace. And we were like the sort of we were kind of like the servants of the palace. We were like these. I always think of Anthony Hopkins in The Remains of the Day. He always comes to mind. This is kind of like noble and dignified servant. You know, this sense of duty and service and care towards the rightful owners of the palace who weren't present at the particular time. We were awaiting their arrival. If the king and queen were going to arrive at some point, and it was our job to make sure everything was looking spick and span, as cared for as, you know, it was their home and we were just serving it. And what we were serving was real majesty, this kind of sense of, like, the sense of complete mystery, in a way that what this figure represents for us. The point where we can no longer talk about anything is the point where the Bodhisattva starts to come into being. And that's what Sangha is. Sangha is the context of serving the Bodhisattva, because it's the Bodhisattva that is the only response to the sufferings of the world. And in a way, that's the vision of a new society. That's the vision of a kind of, certainly a society I want to be a part of. Hopefully you guys do. But when we live unitedly, we bring into being something more than we can imagine. Something beyond language. Something that isn't not just a neat symbol, but it's more than a symbol. It's something alive. It's the best way of talking about it. And it's a new society in a sacred world. And that's all I want to say. Yeah, thank you.